Special two-parter for you now on Coast to Coast AM. For the first couple hours here, we're going to talk about the Lucifer effect, understanding how good people turn evil. And then later on, we're going to talk about what makes a hero. All that is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Philip Zimbardo has served as president of the American Psychological Association, professor emeritus at Stanford University. What a school that is. And Dr. Zimbardo has spent 50 years teaching, studying psychology, best known for the controversial Stanford prison experiment that highlighted the ease in which ordinary, intelligent college students could cross the line between good and evil when caught up in that matrix of being in a situation, a very strange situation. Dr. Zimbardo, currently teaching, of course, at Palo Alto University, and his current research looks at the psychology of heroism. Here he is on Coast to Coast. Philip, how are you?
I'm fine, George. Glad to be on your program.
Likewise. Let's go back a little bit. Tell us about the Stanford prison experiment. What was that?
Well, back in 1971, I did an experiment, which is a demonstration to follow up on a study that my high school classmate had done, Stanley Milgram, in 1960. Milgram's study put ordinary people, mostly men, men ages 20 to 50, in a situation where they were encouraged to give painful electric shock to a stranger who supposedly they were helping him by hurting him. They were supposedly trying to improve his memory by punishing errors. And the surprising thing was that two-thirds of all the people he studied, and that was up to 1,000 individuals, went all the way up to 450 volts, even though the learner, the student in the other room, was screaming and yelling, please, I don't want to be part of this. And so that was a study of blind obedience to authority. My sense is you're really in a situation where somebody says do a bad thing. You know, we live in institutions, in families, in schools, in businesses, where people set a procedure. We play roles. You know, we're the teacher, we're the learner, we're the interviewer, et cetera, et cetera. And those roles have rules. This is what you should do. This is what you do to get along. You go along to get along. And so what I wanted to do was say, what happens if you put really good people in an evil place? Prisons by nature are evil places, as you know, the prison rebellion going on, the hunger strikes in America. But prisons are really all about power. Guards have to demonstrate to prisoners that they have all the power and prisoners have none. So what happens if you have a prison where everybody is good? Everybody's good guys. And the sad thing was that we were going to have... So prisoners lived in the prison for 24 hours, 24-7. Guards worked 8-hour shifts. We picked kids who were normal and healthy on every dimension, psychological tests. These were kids from all over the United States who happened to be in the Stanford area near San Francisco in the summer of 1971. Again, 1971, these are kids who are anti-war activists, civil rights activists. They're all hippies. Everybody's got hair, you know, down to their shoulders.
Yeah.
But it didn't matter. Once they put on the uniform as a guard, they became guards, meaning their job was to demonstrate to the prisoners that they had all the power. They did it in creatively evil ways, day in and day out. So I had to end the study after 6 days. It was supposed to go for 2 weeks because it was out of control.
They were too evil, weren't they?
Yeah, they were creatively evil. I mean, they kept saying... See, the other thing that you don't realize is one of the motivations for evil is boredom. You got an 8-hour shift. In Abu Ghraib, where I also studied, I was an expert witness for one of the guards there, our prison guards. They had 12-hour shifts in the middle of the night. You get bored. Prisoners become your playthings. One of our guards said they were our puppets. We were the puppet masters, you know, controlling them, pulling their strings. And we got our jollies off by doing that.
They had nothing else to do, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, of course they could sit and play cards. They could, I guess they couldn't watch movies in those days. But they could have done some other things. But their job was to relate to the prisoners. And, you know, not humanely, not teaching the prisoners, good lessons, but teaching them the lesson of power. So really, evil is really about the intentional use of power to harm, hurt, corrupt, and in the extreme, to kill innocent people.
Would you say that the experiment was successful, or maybe too successful?
Well, you see, what really the underlying concept that the experiment tries to demonstrate is, what are the main influences on human behavior, on any human behavior? In general, most psychology and the public opinion is, it's all what we are is a product of our genes and our personality that are relatively fixed. However, this study and the Milgram study and other studies that I have done says that human beings are always in a social, situational context that we underestimate. But those contexts are pervasive and they're profound, and really they have an extreme influence on what we are, what we become, and how we behave. And we don't want to hear that. We want to think that we have, in quote, free will, that we choose what we do, that who we are is determined by our taste. And we ignore the fact that most of what we do, we're conforming to friends, to family, to buddies, to national images.
Do you believe, Phil, that most people on this planet are good people?
Oh, sure. Even, I'm an optimist, even after being part of, this evil-generating experiment. I think most people are good. People are not born bad or born good and get corrupted. I believe people are born good, and most people stay good the rest of their life. It's only when those people get trapped in certain situations. I grew up in poverty in the South Bronx, in the inner-city ghetto, South Bronx, and I had friends who were really good kids who did really bad stuff, who went to prison. Some of them got killed. Why did they do it? Because there were guys there, older guys, who preyed on kids to get them to do things for money. If you're poor, you do things for money. You steal, you sell drugs. If you're a girl, they get you to sell your body. And if you're a middle class, you don't have to do things for money. You just ask your parents, hey, I need money, and they give it to you. They do some menial job. So again, in a city, any place in the world, it's a breeding ground for evil, and it doesn't matter if you're good or bad. Now, I always thought, even as a kid, how come I and some of my other friends didn't do it? And one of the keys was having a good family. Typically, it was having a mother who was there and having a father who was around most of the time, at least.
Right.
And so you need those role models. You need somebody to say, hey, this is wrong, this is right. Now, religion used to play that role, and schools used to play that role, but they don't do it in the same way anymore, I think.
I guess people can be pushed to the brink to be evil as well, can't they, Phil?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, you're pushed to the brink but the situation pushes you. It's part of our literature. I mean, there's lots of literature that show, you're poor, your wife needs some medicine, to treat an illness, and so you're going to steal that you ordinarily would not do if you had health insurance, if you had health benefits. So poverty is one of the things that pushes us to the extreme, and also the other thing the one thing that we know is that when children have been abused, half of them learn that the way you deal with other people is by abuse. And so what we know from lots of research is half of all people who have been abused become abusers when they're adults.
Yeah,
and we see this, rampantly in our society. I mean, the other thing, of course, is every society has stereotypes. That, obviously for 100 years, it was okay for whites to lynch or burn alive blacks, black men typically, for any.
You there with us, Phil? Oh, we lost him. And we'll get you back on. And Phil Zimbardo with us. He just merely disappeared, my friends. How often does that happen here? Now, but anyways, we're talking about one of his studies. The Stanford Prison Experiment, which really he did two things with that. One was, of course, he wanted to see how good people turned evil. And the other thing is he wanted to exemplify how people become heroic in certain circumstances and situations as well. And it's a fascinating study. And this is a two-part program for you, because later on in the program, Elizabeth Svoboda is going to join us. And she, too, is a science journalist who is studying, you know, what makes somebody a hero. I mean, when you see people, you know, in episodes happening, it's truly unbelievable how other people will step in and help somebody and other people will not. Here's an example. You're on a train in New York and somebody pulls a knife on somebody. I guarantee you there'll be somebody there who will try to step in and do something. But most people probably won't. And it's just the way it is. We're still trying to get a hold of Phil. And if we don't get him pretty soon, we're going to go to open lines for you, because he may have some serious phone problems. See if we can pick him up. If not, let me give you the numbers, though, just in case. We might want to go to some open lines. West of the Rockies, just to be on the safe side, 800-618-8255. This stuff happens. East of the Rockies, 800-825-5033. First-time caller is 818-501-4721. The wild card line, of course, is 818-501-4109. I think we have him back. He's on his cell phone now. There you go, Phil. What happened? We lost you.
Yeah, no, my phone just went dead.
Oh,
I'm
boy.
Sorry. Hey,
are you on a remote, a portable phone or, yeah. Or a landline?
Yeah, it's a portable one. I don't have a landline.
Okay, well, let's make sure you're plugged in with your cell phone later, and
okay.
We'll continue. Anyways, one of the things I talked to myself for about 6 minutes. So
okay.
I have now went through your entire program.
Okay.
The experiment itself, what surprised you about the Stanford Prison Experiment?
Well, what was surprising is the rapidity and the extent of the change in character of these young men who were college students from all over the United States who came in, again, as I said earlier, it's 1971. This is an era that everybody was anti-authority. When we interviewed the kids who applied, we put an ad in the local paper. Nobody wanted to be a guard. Guards were pigs. You know, but I'm saying all you had to do was put them in a uniform and then give them the camaraderie of other guys who are also guards, put them on the yard, and make clear that they were in charge. That was enough to set off this character transformation of good kids into evil guards. Well, we saw the same thing in Abu Ghraib. I mean, I defended in a court-martial one of the guards, Chip Frederick, who is the sergeant in charge of the night shift, and he was as good a soldier as he was Army Reserve, as good a soldier as imaginable, 9 medals and awards. Sure. And you put him in that dungeon, and the situation was exactly like the Stanford Prison Study. You put him in that setting, and suddenly, within a few weeks, he and every guard on the night shift, 9 out of 9, are doing those horrible things we saw in the images. Well, those images that were released back in, I guess it was 2004, were only a small number of the 1,000 images that I got to see as an expert witness. And many of them were even more horrific than were shown on television.
And these are people, Phil, who would never do this under any other circumstance, right?
Well, none. I mean, I checked this guy out. From the time he was in kindergarten, he never had a single negative thing on his record. An exemplary soldier. I said 9 medals and awards, and you put him in that unique situation. You know, the situation is, suddenly, when the insurgency took over in Iraq, when Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld said, hey, we won the war, well, they didn't know about improvised explosive devices that started killing our soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a clue about the insurgency. So they started arresting all the men and boys around every explosion. What that meant was that on the night shift, the prison population went from 200 to 1,000.
Wow.
in a few weeks.
They couldn't handle
it. They were not equipped to handle that. Many of the prisoners were naked. They were filthy. There were not showers. They didn't speak English, and so suddenly they were like animals. And, you know, they looked like animals, they smelled like animals, and they began to be treated like animals. So we call it dehumanization. So dehumanization is a psychological process by which people begin to think of others as less than human.
Is that still going on, Phil, do you think?
Oh, sure. No, it's basic in prejudice. I mean, all prejudice around the world is creating an image of the other. And often before we go to war, we have these dehumanized images of the enemy, and we do it so that citizens will learn, come to hate the other and be willing to send your sons and our daughters to war to kill the other.
Let's equate the Stanford Prison Experiment with a real-life situation now out here in the real world.
Okay.
Where we're not in a prison, but we're on this planet.
Right.
What would happen similarly to create this kind of evil in people on this planet?
Well, all you need is somebody who has power. In this case, I was the superintendent of the prison. I was the person who created this system. So it was a system of power. And so essentially, we have this right now. Every prison, virtually every prison in the world that is originally created to rehabilitate people so they won't commit the crimes again, do exactly the opposite. You know, at least 60% of every person who goes, 60% of all prisoners become recidivists. That means within 3 years, they do, they get back in for the same or usually more extreme crimes.
So it doesn't go away, does it?
No, it gets worse. So and the question is, what happens in prisons is that they learn more criminal behavior. Prisons are places of evil. Okay, what it means, the worst thing you could be is go to prison as a youngster without gang connections, because then automatically you become somebody's sissy, somebody's girlfriend.
Well, listen to this, Phil. In St. Louis County, they've got a jail in the county. And a guy was released from jail. He spent his time in there. They released him. The first thing he did is he broke into a valet guy's little wooden stand, took a key, and stole a car. And they caught the guy down the block. And they said, you just got out of jail. What'd you do this for? He said, well, I needed a ride. They don't learn anything in prison, do they? By the way, we have the largest prison listenership right now. People in prison are listening to you, Phil, talking to me right now. And I think most of them would agree it's very difficult to rehabilitate. And then you put somebody back out into the real world again, and they don't have anything. They pick up their old traits again, don't they?
I'm very glad that you have prisoners listening. I send them my regards. And my sympathy goes out to them because, you know, rich people don't go to prison. You know, it's only rarely that people who are involved in corruption or fraud get to go to prison. You know, so again, prisons are populated mostly with poor people, mostly with minorities, with African Americans, Hispanics. And we know even for relatively minor crimes, they get much longer sentences than Caucasians do. But once you're in prison, you know, it becomes a life sentence because all you got to do is break a rule and then they add time on.
Okay? That's right. Philip, hold on. We're going to be right back with you on Coast to Coast AM. Beyond Belief is our television program. It pops up every Friday. So take a look at that. And by the way, some of those days may change eventually, giving you more widespread times to watch the program. John St. Augustine will be with us talking about near-death experiences Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. You can take a look at that program, and 7 p.m. Central Time as well. Simply go to beyondbelief.com. 10 days free to look at the program and all the other videos. beyondbelief.com. And welcome back. Phil Zimbardo with us this hour and next hour as well. We'll take phone calls next hour as we talk about his work, The Lucifer Effect, understanding how good people turn evil. What percent of the people, Phil, do you think are good but can be turned evil?
Oh, I'd say the majority. I don't know. I can't give you a percentage, but in all the research and in all the naturally existing answers, examples of evil, It turns out to be the majority can be seduced, can be corrupted across that line between good and evil. But again, it has to be within powerful situations. And so the protection against those are families that have clear values, that teach their kids right from wrong, that, you know, it used to be the job of religion to teach morals, to teach ethics. We used to have that in school. There would be lessons about you know, the importance of being good and respect. All of that has seemed to have dropped out. Now, there's a new movement in psychology called positive psychology, started by Marty Seligman at the University of Pennsylvania, which says, why don't we begin to focus on what is good and normal and healthy about people, rather than having a psychology focused on disease and illness and negative things. This program is being adopted in many, many schools to begin to teach people the importance of kindness, of compassion, of generosity, of gratitude, you know, things that are essential to creating a positive quality of a social emotional environment. Even the whole notion that we should be teaching, you know, social emotional intelligence rather than just teaching, you know, for textbook intelligence, you know, science, math, technology level.
Well, you know, let me ask you this then: with all this evil that seems to be all over the place with us, can we win in the long run? Can we defeat evil?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's really the the ultimate human battle of good versus evil. I mean, we create superheroes, you know, Superman, Batman, et cetera, in our fantasy world as our heroes who are going to oppose evil. But we don't need that. Essentially, what we need is, how do we inspire most people, ordinary people, to begin to be heroes in training? So I don't know if this is getting ahead in your program, but in the last chapter of my book, The Lucifer Effect, what I talk about is that, you know, in every situation we've looked at, there's always, at the very least, a handful of people who can resist these powerful situational forces. And I said, maybe we should think of them as heroes, people who somehow are able to resist the power of these social situations that corrupt so many others. And the question is, how do they do it? And so I outlined some ideas of what is it that people do who can resist the negativity. And then I begin to talk about heroism. Well, the interesting thing is there's almost no research in psychology, in sociology, in any field on heroes and heroism. It's really a paradox that there's a lot of research on aggression, on violence, on crime, but very little research and on conflict, very little research on heroes and heroism. So to challenge that, I started a foundation in San Francisco called the Heroic Imagination Project, and we call it HIP. And essentially, we have educational programs that teach young people in middle school, high school, college, and we hope to work down to primary school, how to be wise and effective heroes. And to be a hero simply is someone who takes action on behalf of others in need, or defends a moral cause. And what makes it heroism rather than altruism is there is a potential high cost or risk, where altruism, it's you know, doing social good with really minimal risk or minimal cost. Well, most people don't want to do it because, you know, they don't want to pay the price. But I'm saying there are little things you could do every day on the path to heroism. So, for example, heroes are sociocentric, meaning heroes notice other people in need and are willing to ask them, are you okay? Do you need help? Are willing to ask other people, come and help me, help this person, this child, this woman. They don't do it alone.
In fact, and without any concern for themselves, right?
No, you have a, well, In extreme, you do it without a concern for yourself. Like this New York City subway hero, Wesley Autry, 2 years ago, I had jumped on a subway track in New York while subway's coming in to save a guy who had fallen across the tracks.
That's
and
right.
he put him between the tracks, pressed him down, and the train went over them, just a half an inch above his head. So that's an impulsive, reactive hero. The other kind of hero are reflective, proactive ones. Whistleblowers typically have to collect information, have to get people on their side, you know. But again, most whistleblowers, you know, become the enemy of the system because they're exposing the system. You know, like we've seen recently with the WikiLeaks heroes / traitors. Now, again, the interesting thing is heroism is really a social attribution. You know, the same person who is a hero for one person is a villain for another. So a suicide bomber in Palestine is a hero to Palestinians. He's a monster to Israelis. The same thing in Iraq, same thing in other countries now. But even things, for example, like recently, I live in San Francisco. My background is Italian, and there's a strong Italian community in San Francisco. We have a street called Columbus Avenue. The nation has a Columbus Day Parade. And until recently, there was some old Italian guy who dressed up like Columbus, came in on a boat. People dressed up as Indians greeted him. A few years ago, he came in, people started throwing tomatoes at him and saying, "Monster, go away." And he said, "What happened? Last year I was a hero, now I'm a monster." It turned out that a Stanford historian uncovered some of Columbus's original writings, where he wrote that these natives are so friendly that it's easy to exploit them, to take their gold, to take their money, to get them to become our slaves.
Yeah.
Well, so now, is he a hero or not? So there's another category called controversial heroes, you know, like the suicide bombers, you know, like this case of Columbus. But I think it's interesting for us to explore the nature of heroism. It's not even a topic that we talk about in schools. And I'm saying it's central to what it means to be good in the extreme, willing to make a sacrifice for other people. So one of the things I do is to say, why don't you think of yourself as a hero in training? What does that mean? It means every day this week, do a little act of kindness. Make somebody feel special and respected. What does that mean? A teacher, a parent, the person who serves you food in the cafeteria. Don't treat them like functionaries. Don't treat them like servants. So what do? You ask their name, you use their name, you look them in the eye, and you give a compliment. A compliment about how they look, a compliment about something they're wearing, a compliment about something they said. You make them feel special and respected. Compliments are dead. You never hear people give compliments anymore. Why not? That's embarrassing. It's awkward. But when you do, it transforms that social situation. Other people smile. They beam. They always say thank you. And typically, they'll give you one back. They say, "Hey, that was really nice of you. You know, thanks for taking the time. I always liked the way you dress. Or I always like how you phrase things." So heroism can start at that simple level.
Well, let me ask you about this case and tell me what you think of it. Of course, the bookkeeper from Georgia, Antoinette Tough, who just a few weeks ago talked down a would-be shooter. And to me, she's a hero. Well, how about you?
Oh, no, absolutely. So this is really a unique case. And I recently published an article with two of my colleagues, Jim Breckenridge, and Fatali Mogadam in a journal called Current Psychology, in which we presented for the first time research data, a survey of a national survey of Americans, 4,000 people we surveyed, and we asked them about heroism. Had they ever done any of the following things that qualify as heroic? And 20% said yes, 800 out of 4,000. And then we looked at, what are the background of these people? Well, you're more likely if you live in a city than an urban area. I mean, a city than a rural area. You're more likely the more educated you are. You're more likely if you're a man than a woman, but that's only because that's focusing on physical bravery, Women are more likely to be heroes when it involves creating a social network to work together. But the most amazing finding was that African-American men and women were twice as likely as Caucasians to engage in a heroic deed, and Hispanics, men but not women, were also much more likely to do heroic deeds. So this Antoinette, is it Tough?
Tough, yep.
Yeah. So she illustrates, I think, a unique quality that in the way she did it, that African-American women speak. She spoke from the heart. She spoke to this person. She spoke at an emotional level. She was not judgmental. You know, she said, you know, if you do this, people will hate you. You don't want people to hate you. In fact, I like you already. In fact, if I got to know you better, I might even love you. So she broke down all the usual barriers. You would never get that with a 911 operator. You would never get that with, you know, a police dispatch team. And she won this kid's heart over.
I really believe, Philip, she'll go visit him wherever he ends up.
Well, I'm sure she will. I'm absolutely sure she will. But again, so she's a model of what we should be doing every day. That kid should have never gotten that far. In all the high school shootings we know, it's almost always a kid who's a loner that has no friends, that everybody knows, you know, he's a good boy, but he didn't have friends, he was a loner. Nobody took the time to say, hey, you know, let's go to the movies together. Hey, let's play a game. Hey, come on the team. Let me show you a new video game. So that, you know, in fact, you know, the worst school shooting was the Korean kid at Virginia Tech a few years ago. And essentially, he made this video saying, I lived with you for 2 years. I went to classes. I went to the dorm. I lived in a dormitory. I ate in the cafeteria. And not one of you befriended me. So I'm going to do something which you will never forget me. Since you can't remember me for the good things, you're going to remember me for the bad things.
Well, but that brings up an interesting question. Yeah. Outside of being on some pharmaceutical drug, what would cause someone to go over the edge like that, even if he's not befriended by people, why go off and kill everybody?
Well, it's rare enough so that there's not a single profile. But see, typically what happens is social isolation is the key. In almost all cases of mass murders, whether they're high school shooting or not, the person, for various reasons, becomes socially isolated, typically lives alone, or if they live in a family, they are socially isolated. They live in their room. They watch video games. They watch pornography, but they don't have an emotional connection to anything. What that means is that when you get a thought, however bizarre, there's no one to challenge it. So you have a crazy thought, and then you repeat it. So this is what we call this autistic thinking. That is, you begin to cycle the same old thought that nobody likes me. People hate me. People are going to harm me. If I don't do something, I got to defend myself. I got to get a gun. I got to get them before they get me. And suddenly, it becomes a very reasonable thing. So it seems, you know, totally unreasonable when it happens. So the person doing it, you know, they're following this illogical set of beliefs that for them are reasonable. So for me, the key is anything that socially isolates you from the community, from your family, from your friends. And so it's not just not being befriended, it's having no one that you can rely on, no one you can say, hey, I'm hurting, hey, I feel bad, hey, I'm sad. But what it means is we all have an obligation in a social community to be sensitive to people in our school, in our work, and who are not connected. And all you got to do is say, you know, hey, let's have a drink together. I mean, it means so little. It takes so little to make somebody feel connected. Now, I'm saying, you know, the example of, you know, being a hero in training by trying to make people feel special. You know, this is part of that. Just make people feel that they are worthwhile. Because if they're not worthwhile, then, and once they believe they're not worthwhile, then nobody else is worthwhile to them. And then you live in a society where we have, you know, easy access to guns. And, you know, and then the result is, you know, kid becomes a killer.
How tragic can that be, too? Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. I mean, But it's a tragedy that happens over and over again. It's not like, hey, let me tell you about Columbine High. I mean, since then, there have been about at least a dozen similar occurrences.
Philip, let's talk for a moment about the bullies. What makes someone do that? Pick on other people, underprivileged people, weaker people. And of course, the bully is the weaker of the two, because if you stand, he backs down most of the time.
Bullying has gotten a lot of attention recently, even though it's something that's been going on for ages. I think what brought bullying to national attention was the cyberbullying. Kids that humiliate other kids online, where you have no way to retaliate and no way to say it's wrong. You know, so online you say, boys like Jenny because she puts out, or Billy gets a good grade because he cheats. Well, there's no way to say that's not true. And if you said it, nobody would believe it. And some of these kids had committed suicide. And so that got national attention, national visibility. But bullying has been going on always. And for me, you know, the focus has always been on the bully and the kid bullied. My focus is on all the bystanders. That is, bullies create, the worst evil for me is bullies create a world of bystanders. All the kids in junior high school, all the kids in high school, all the kids, people at work, who know somebody's being bullied and look the other way.
They look the other way.
So that's the evil of inaction. By their silence, they give power to the bully. Because the bully looks around and people smile, they feel awkward, look away, and the bully keeps doing it. And all you have to do is say, hey, I wish you wouldn't do that. It's really not fair to that kid. You know, don't do it. Or you get a bunch of kids together, a bunch of people at work, you know, to simply say, hey, don't do it. It's really not right. If you stop doing it, we'll be your friend. You know, you don't have to do that to make friends.
Does the bully have a friend at all?
Typically not. Now, the only exception, so bullying is a power ploy. Bullying is like one of our guards, you know, who's going to use the power. But in the prison situation, the system gives the guard power. You put on the uniform, you get the billy club, you get the handcuffs, you have the gun. So you have the power credentials. So bully just looks like anybody else in the class. And now bullying is now a major problem in business. Businesses lose 10% of their profits because of rampant bullying. That means that people who are bullied don't work as efficiently. They often call in sick, and sometimes they quit their job and transfer. So you lose all the money that you put into training. So it is still a national problem. But bullies typically don't have friends. The only difference is, Among typically junior high school or high school girls, sometimes you'll have a clique of girls who are bullies. And the point is, they then do it it's almost like to excite one another. They pick on some kid.
Like a club.
And then, make her feel stupid or dumb or whatever. But that's really rare. It's almost like the kid is a class clown.
Phil, we're going to talk a little bit more with you about this, and then we'll take some phone calls next hour on Coast to Coast AM.